From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the Ukrainian side of the impeachment drama. New York Times reporter Andrew Kramer speaks to us from Kiev, where he says the new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is in a tough spot responding to President Trump's requests for investigations into Joe Biden's son and the 2016 election.
Zelensky's really been trying hard to stay on the fence on this issue. He may be dealing with a President Biden next year, or he may be dealing with President Trump.
Kramer says politicized investigations are common in Ukraine, and ambitious players in the country may be willing to share information or rumors to gain favor with Americans on one side or the other in the impeachment fight. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by country singer John Party, who Ken says is making excellent honky-tonk music, and Justin Chang reviews Scorsese's new film, The Irishman. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A curious feature of the impeachment drama unfolding in Washington is that so much of it has to do with Ukraine, a former Soviet republic that's been independent for just 28 years. President Trump and his lawyer Rudy Giuliani have sought to get Ukraine's government to investigate Joe Biden's son Hunter's business dealings, and Trump asked Ukraine's new president to investigate a discredited theory that Ukraine was involved in the 2016 hack of the Democratic National Committee's emails. We're going to take a closer look at Ukraine and how players in its own turbulent politics have interacted with American actors in the impeachment saga. Our guest is Andrew Kramer, a reporter for The New York Times who's based in Moscow and has been reporting on Ukraine for several years. In 2017, he shared a Pulitzer Prize with his Times colleagues for an investigative series on Russia's use of covert means to exert its power. Andrew Kramer spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies yesterday from his studio in Kiev.
Andrew Kramer, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, Ukraine's been an independent country just since 1991, and it hasn't exactly been a smooth transition. And reading about the events in recent years, gosh, lots of tales of corruptions, of oligarchs being connected to politicians, of prosecutions that in some cases maybe seem politically connected. Everybody has an angle, it seems. And I wonder if you could just, could you talk a bit about Kiev, what it's like and what it's like reporting there?
Kiev is a beautiful city. It has cobblestone streets, old quarters on bluffs overlooking the Dnieper River. It's also a city that in recent years has been the equivalent of some of the Cold War dens of intrigue like Berlin, or maybe you might compare it to Casablanca in World War II, a city that's in between two forces, between two struggling or competing political systems. So you have spies, agents, journalists of Russia and of the West all active in this city.
And it's got to be hard to figure out when you're getting the real story. I mean, right?
Well, that's certainly the case. There's been a lot of misinformation in Ukraine, not least because Ukraine has been on the front lines of some of the Russian disinformation activities in recent years. But it's also been a place for spin doctors from the West and Ukraine's own oligarchs and politicians who are presenting different narratives about this country's future and how this country should interact with the West. And it's actually these competing narratives, which is part of the story behind the impeachment inquiry in the United States now.
Ukraine is a pretty large country, 42 million people, historically dominated by Russia, at least in recent decades, but in the past by other empires. And now there are connections with the West and ambitions among Ukrainian politicians for closer ties to the United States and Western countries. How does Ukraine's geopolitical position affect its domestic politics?
Well, that's really a pivotal issue in Ukraine's domestic politics is the clashing geopolitical ambitions of countries around Ukraine. And it's not a new story for this country. When the modern Ukraine was formed in the 17th century on the steppe land between the Western Europe and the Russian Empire, it was already being pulled in both directions. We see this in the 20th century, and we see it again in the 21st century. When Ukraine gained independence in 1991, it was closely linked to Russia. There were industrial supply chains that linked Ukraine to Russia, energy pipelines, and Europe was pulling Ukraine away from the former Soviet Union, from the former Soviet space, and at the same time, Russia was pulling back. And it was this clash and this struggle for Ukraine that really defined its foreign policy and also its domestic policy of the past 30 years.
Right. And then it's in recent years moved more to the West and has looked for friends and allies in the U.S. and other countries. Does that help explain why operatives like Paul Manafort could become so active and Hunter Biden might end up on the board of a gas company?
Well, that's exactly right. You have ambitious actors in Ukraine, oligarchs and politicians who are looking for patrons in the West, particularly after the 2014 revolution, but also before then, and willing to pay large sums of money to align themselves with lobbyists or politicians in the United States. And we saw this famously with Paul Manafort, but also Rudolph Giuliani has taken contracts from Ukrainian oligarchs. Hunter Biden, Donald Trump was paid $150,000 by a Ukrainian oligarch to give a speech in 2015. Hillary Clinton for the Clinton Foundation also accepted money from that oligarch. So a lot of Western figures have found a source of profit in Ukraine and have chosen these wealthy Ukrainians as their guides to the country, and in exchange for money accepted some of their narrative and their ideas of about what Ukraine should become. And this is the backdrop to what's happening today.
So let's talk about some of the recent history. In 2014, there were street demonstrations and clashes, which resulted in the departure of the president, then Viktor Yanukovych. Tell us about him. What kind of regime he ran?
Well, certainly. Viktor Yanukovych was a politician who was allied with Russia, but also, like many Ukrainian politicians, was trying to straddle the fence. He had entered negotiations on trade agreements both with Russia and with the European Union, and this came to a head in 2013 when he realized he wouldn't be able to sign these agreements with both camps, with both the European Union and with Russia. And after initially promising his people, promising that he would integrate Ukraine economically with the European Union, at the very last moment he switched and made a trade agreement with Russia, which was part of a larger political project of Vladimir Putin to reintegrate parts of the former Soviet Union in what became known as the Eurasian Union. Street protests broke out against this policy, and they snowballed into ever larger protests on Independence Square until February of 2014, when police opened fire into the crowd. There was, in fact, shooting on both sides, but a lot of protesters bore the brunt of this violence, and about 70 people were killed in the space of an hour and a half or so on Independence Square, and thousands were wounded over several days. This resulted in Yanukovych fleeing Kiev when his police deserted him and departing for Moscow and leaving a power vacuum in the Ukrainian capital that was only gradually filled, first over weeks and then over months, with a new government that was propped up by the United States.
And when demonstrators reached the residence that Yanukovych had inhabited and got inside, what did they find?
Well, I was with the demonstrators who came in. It was a foggy morning in late February, and some of them climbed over a gate and then broke it open. And you had a view of opulence that was almost unimaginable for most Ukrainians. A private golf course, a collection of antique cars, a zoo with ostriches, and a number of other luxuries. But intriguingly also, what they found were documents floating in a river harbor, and some documents which had been partly burned. And it was these documents that were never meant to come to the surface, never meant to be seen by the public, that really were a ticking time bomb for the intersection of Ukrainian politics and U.S. politics, because hidden in this collection of documents, found not just at the residence, but also on the floor of a sauna of a former prosecutor and in a safe in the former political party of Mr. Yanukovych, were details of Paul Manafort's work in Ukraine.
Manafort had helped Yanukovych get power and then was still active in Ukraine after Yanukovych left, when remnants of his party remained active. Tell us about what these documents said and what impact they had on Paul Manafort and the Trump campaign.
Well, certainly it turned out that the most extensive records of Manafort's activities in Ukraine were included in the handwritten accounting documents kept by the Party of Regions, the party of former President Yanukovych, and they included payments designated for Manafort for things like polling, for even overhead items like computers for his office, as well as payments for his consulting services over several years, totaling $12.7 million. These were off-the-book payments and were considered illegal in Ukraine. And when we wrote about this in August of 2016, Manafort and his attorneys denied that this could be the case and suggested the documents were forged. But there was a lot of confidence that, in fact, they were not. And we published the story, and Manafort resigned from the campaign about a week later.
And just to kind of set the context here, this is Viktor Yanukovych, who lived in opulence in what was regarded as, you know, riches essentially stolen from the Ukrainian people. He was a pro-Russian president. He flees, and then it's in the records of his party that you find these secret payments to Manafort, not at all helpful to the Trump campaign. Is this part of the origin of Trump's belief that Ukrainians were always out to get him and help Hillary Clinton?
I think so. You saw now in the most recent episodes involving Ukraine, when Trump released the transcript of his call with the Ukrainian president, he was talking about bad things that happened in Ukraine and things that our country, meaning the America, went through because of Ukraine. Also, we know from some of the interviews and testimony of diplomats and aides to President Trump in the inquiry, the impeachment inquiry, that Trump had said that Ukraine tried to take him down in 2016. And most of this feeling, most of this impression, I believe, is related to the disclosures of financial wrongdoing by his campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, which was a blow to the Trump campaign in August of 2016.
You know, when you look at events in Ukraine, it seems that high-profile prosecutions are pretty common. Have they become just an accepted weapon in political competition there?
When protesters took to the streets of Kiev in 2014, the politicized use of the prosecutor's office was one of the issues that they were protesting against. One of the symbols of the uprising on Independence Square was a poster showing the face of a former prime minister, Yulia Tymoshenko, who's best known in the West for her long blonde braid. She was imprisoned by the president at the time, Viktor Yanukovych. Ms. Tymoshenko had run against Yanukovych in 2010 and lost. And then soon after the election, she was locked up in prison on charges which were widely seen as political and had been in jail for several years by the time that protest came about. But it was a poignant symbol of the type of problem in their government that was upsetting protesters.
What were the charges against Tymoshenko, this woman who ran against Yanukovych?
Tymoshenko was charged and convicted with exceeding her authority in negotiating a natural gas deal with Russia. The accusation was that as prime minister, she could not give a direct order to the head of the government-controlled natural gas company, but rather this order needed to come via the energy ministry. So it was a very technical administrative issue of Ukrainian governance that was used as a criminal case against her. And she was convicted to 5 or 6 years in prison on this issue, which was generally seen as a political pretext, a pretext for a political prosecution to remove her from political life and put her in jail.
Andrew Kramer is a reporter for The New York Times based in Moscow. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're talking about Ukraine, its history, politics, and its connections to the impeachment inquiry unfolding in Washington with Andrew Kramer. He's a reporter for The New York Times based in Moscow. He's covered events in Ukraine for the past several years. So, Andrew Kramer, when did Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, start working in Ukraine to get authorities interested in investigating matters of interest to the president?
Well, to the best of our understanding, this began in 2018, perhaps late 2018, when he reached out to the Prosecutor General of Ukraine, Yuri Lutsenko, or alternatively, by another version, Mr. Lutsenko reached out to him, and they discussed two cases which could be politically useful to Donald Trump in the 2020 election in the United States. This was an investigation relevant to the former Vice President, Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter Biden, and what's been called by Trump administration officials a look back at 2016, which is an investigation into whether Ukraine meddled in the U.S. election in 2016 to favor Hillary rather than Russia meddling to favor Trump.
Right. Now, while Giuliani is busy doing what he can to make contact there, there's an election this spring. The incumbent president then, Petro Poroshenko, found himself in trouble when seeking re-election. Why?
Well, Poroshenko was admired when he came into office, but patience had quickly run out with his stalling on reform and his embrace of a very hardline form of Ukrainian nationalism, which he ran on in the election. So Poroshenko came into the election with very low poll ratings and was searching around for perhaps some help and maybe even backing from the United States. Maybe he wanted an endorsement from President Trump before the election. And this outreach and interaction between Giuliani and his own prosecutor occurred with the backdrop of the Ukrainian election taking place.
Ukraine gets a new president, Volodymyr Zelensky. An interesting character. Tell us about him.
Sure. Zelensky was a TV actor in Ukraine, and he emerged in the 1990s in comedy shows, which are called The Club of the Merry and the Inventive, something like this, which are kind of something of a combination between a Jeopardy, where you have to answer trivia questions, and a stand-up routine. And then you're graded. Each team is graded on how they do. And he was very successful as a teenager and then as a young adult playing in these competitions. And then he became a comedic actor, was popular throughout the former Soviet Union and in the entire Russian-speaking world for comedy sketches and also for movies and TV shows. In maybe 2015, I'm not sure exactly when the show began or when the taping of it began, but he initiated a program which was a parody of post-revolution Ukraine about how the political system after the revolution had not, in fact, reformed, that the same trends of corruption were present that were there before the revolution. And he played a teacher who had become, almost by accident, become president of Ukraine. And he played this through several series. It was very popular, playing a sort of naive everyman version of Ukraine's president before he became exactly that this year.
Yeah, and this is so remarkable. I mean, he was actually taping a new season of it while he was campaigning for president, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's what he was doing. Now, at this point, it looks a little bit less interesting and curious and more like a ploy to get around some restrictions on using TV advertising, because this show was aired during the campaign and yet was presented as if it was an artistic product. And many of his ideas of the campaign were also included in the latest show. But that's exactly what happened. He continued the show right up to the moment when he was actually elected president.
Right. And the name of the show was Servant of the People, and there were campaign advertisements which incorporated the title of the TV series into the campaign material, right?
That's right. And his political party is called Servant of the People.
Zelensky is Jewish. Is that significant in any way?
Yes, I think it certainly is. Zelensky ran on a different message about what it means to be Ukrainian. The previous president had promoted an idea of Ukrainian nationalism as tied to the Ukrainian language, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and Ukrainian identity as really one of faith and blood and soil. And Zelensky had a different view of what Ukrainian means, an understanding of Ukrainian in the current context as a country that supports freedom, that supports democracy, that is an inclusive identity about a political point of view rather than an ethnic or linguistic identity, so that you could be Russian-speaking, as Zelensky himself was. You can be Jewish, you can be Hungarian, or any other minority in Ukraine, and no less of a Ukrainian. And this was a message that a majority of Ukrainians accepted when he came in. His political party, the Servant of the People, put on its party list the first black Ukrainian who won a seat in parliament, which is another view of what it means to be Ukrainian. You can be an immigrant and also be a Ukrainian.
Did Zelensky win by a large majority in the election?
He did. He won in a landslide with more than 70% of Ukrainians voting for him in all regions, in the east and also in the west, in Ukrainian-speaking areas and in Russian-speaking areas.
Does he remain popular?
He is popular.
And why was he popular in Russian-speaking areas?
Well, he was popular because he wasn't denigrating their experience. He wasn't telling them that their beliefs, what they had in their head, the language they spoke was mush, and that they should become Ukrainian in the sense of speaking the Ukrainian language, and not appreciating their own cultural identity, perhaps as Russian-speaking Jews, for example, living in Ukraine. This would be valued, and this was a message which even Ukrainians in Western Ukraine appreciated, and also in Russian-speaking areas.
And the fictional character that he plays is successful in part because he confronts oligarchs and battles corruption, right, and promises to bring a new era of clean politics. So he wins office. How clean is he?
Well, a lot of the diplomatic community in Kiev and analysts are looking closely at that question and are willing to give Zelensky the benefit of the doubt for now. His stated positions are positive. The real dramatic question which is hanging over the Zelensky administration now is his relationship with an oligarch named Ihor Kolomoisky, who was the owner of the television station where his show had aired, and he was a business partner with Zelensky. Kolomoisky had been in exile until the election. He just recently returned to Ukraine and has now been involved in influencing the Zelensky government to the extent that the International Monetary Fund has declined to offer its latest aid package. So in domestic politics, the question of whether the TV character is similar to the real-life president is really the open question here, whether he will confront the oligarchic class, in particular somebody deemed his patron, or whether it won't be so much life imitating art as just life continuing on as usual in Ukraine.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air's Dave Davies recorded with Andrew Kramer, a reporter for the New York Times based in Moscow. After a break, he'll tell us more about Ukraine's actor-turned-president and about visiting the front lines of the war in eastern Ukraine. Also, Ken Tucker will review the new album by country singer John Party, who Ken says is making excellent honky-tonk music, and Justin Chang will review Martin Scorsese's new film, The Irishman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from Neon with Parasite, a dark comedy thriller about two very different families whose fates cross in a tale of class, greed, and deception. Now playing in select cities. Paradise-Movie for more theater info.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're listening to the interview Dave Davies recorded with New York Times reporter Andrew Kramer about Ukraine and the role the country and its politicians have played in the events leading to the impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump. Kramer was in a studio in Kiev. When they left off, they were talking about Ukraine's new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, a former comedian and actor.
Actors getting into politics is not unheard of. You know, Ronald Reagan was an actor, although he had been governor of a large state before he entered the White House. Trump, of course, was a reality show host, although he had a business career before that. Zelensky really has just been an actor, right, and a comedian.
That's right. He has no government experience before being elected president. He's 41 years old. There's one distinction here in Ukraine, which is that this is a country at war. It's not perhaps a time to be experimenting, or that's how Ukrainians view this. And so while Zelensky came in as a comedian in office, he's been not nearly as lighthearted as he was as a character in his television show. The war has now been going on for 5 years, or at least 13,000 people have been killed in the fighting in eastern Ukraine. And this was, along with fighting corruption and freeing the country from oligarchic influences, finding a peace settlement in the war in eastern Ukraine was a priority of Zelensky when he came in, and was the reason why he was so eager to have a White House meeting with President Trump, because he wanted the United States to take a more active role in the diplomatic settlement process with Russia to pressure Russia to end the war.
Right. And we haven't mentioned this in this interview, but yeah, that around the time that Russia annexed Crimea, its agents were in fighting in eastern Ukraine and have occupied parts of the country. And so there's an ongoing conflict there.
Well, that's right. And that's an interesting, also an interesting point, because the West and Western governments have correctly been pressuring Ukraine to solve these problems of corruption. And it's said that the country has two struggles, one against its internal dysfunctions, its feuds, its corruption, the sort of patronage that is run like any other former Soviet country. And the other struggle is the struggle for independence from Russia, which is the war in the East and the effort to avoid return or resurgence of Russian influence in Ukraine.
I just wanted to get your sense of President Zelensky. I don't know if you've spoken with him, but do you see him as someone of substance and conviction?
Well, I think that he's from a very difficult business environment, business and entertainment environment. He worked in Russia and also in Ukraine, and you know, in an environment where there really was no safety net, and he did well. So he's a man with a lot of street smarts coming into this job, and he's also somebody who doesn't have any baggage in Ukrainian politics. So it's really turning a new page for Ukraine, and it's about hope that this individual will be different than those who came before. For now, we haven't seen much reason to doubt that. Obviously, the phone call with President Trump, in which Zelensky eagerly agreed to pursue a politicized investigation of Joe Biden, is cause for concern.
You know, we said that there was this prosecutor under the previous president, Lutsenko, who had opened investigations or had made legal moves in the direction of investigating Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, as well as the matters of 2016. What has been the posture of President Zelensky on these investigations? I mean, he seemed to be willing to sound cooperative with President Trump on the phone. What's actually happened in terms of initiating investigations, if anything?
What's happened is that the new prosecutor has said he will audit these cases, which just leaves a big question mark over them. And does that mean they'll soon be reopened, or does that mean they'll be closed? So Zelensky's really been trying hard to stay on the fence on this issue.
He really has to walk a fine line here, doesn't he?
Exactly. He may be dealing with a President Biden next year, or he may be dealing with President Trump.
This is Fresh Air, and we're talking about Ukraine, its politics, its history, and its connection to the impeachment drama unfolding in Washington. Our guest is Andrew Kramer. He's a reporter for the New York Times based in Moscow, and he has covered events in Ukraine for several years. Let's talk about the war in eastern Ukraine. This grew out of 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea, and then Russian-backed troops are fighting there. Just generally describe the situation in this war. How much progress have the Russians made? How much progress have the government forces made?
Certainly. The war had an active phase in 2014 when Russian-backed separatists and Russian activists and agents fomented an uprising in two provinces in eastern Ukraine. We had street demonstrations and then local officials being assassinated or driven out of towns and replaced by pro-Russian figures, all in rapid succession over several months, leading up to an actual military incursion by the Russians in the summer of 2014, and then a response from the Ukrainian army, which was to deploy artillery and tanks and soldiers into the east in what became really a pitched battle in the flatlands of eastern Ukraine, fought over this farmland, the sunflower fields, and in the industrial cities of the country's east for August and part of September of 2014. And then there was a peace settlement, first one in September called the Minsk Agreement, followed by a second iteration of that agreement in February and March of 2015 called Minsk II. And after that, the war went into an abeyance. It was settled into a stalemate along a trench front of several hundred miles through the this rural part of Ukraine. And what's really striking about this war, and something that I've really noticed, is that the people on both sides of this front line are the same. They came from the same either industrial cities or rural areas, mostly Russian-speaking, some Ukrainian-speaking. There's no ethnic linguistic difference between them. This is a war about politics. It's a war about two different political systems that are clashing. And this is the front line of that clash. It's something like the Berlin Wall, where you have a wall dividing Germans with no distinction between them other than politics. And this new dividing line is the trench line in eastern Ukraine.
And did you say most of the forces on the government side are also Russian-speaking?
Well, many of them are. I don't think most now, but initially the paramilitary organizations, the pro-Ukrainian paramilitary organizations, including the most significant, which was backed by Ihor Kolomoisky, now the patron of Zelensky, were Russian-speaking. Russian was the language of radio communication, of commands, and of banter in the bunkers and in the trenches, just as it was on the other side.
Huh. But one side wants to ally with Russia. The other side treasures Ukrainian independence.
That's right. There was a difference of politics. It was about a view of what sort of governance the country should have. And it really began on Independence Square in the uprising in the capital in 2013 and 14, which became violent. And then it continued in the war. In the struggle between authoritarianism and liberal democracy in Eastern Europe, the Ukrainians became the steel that didn't bend in the protests and also in the war. There's been this very stubborn ability of the Ukrainian paramilitary organizations, activists, the army, to hold out for really political causes in this conflict.
You visited a unit on the front lines in Ukraine, right? What did you observe?
Well, the war is fought in trench lines, like World War One, and there's a peculiarity of the Eastern Ukraine war in that neither side uses aviation, because the separatist groups have Russian-supplied anti-aircraft weapons that have cleared the skies of Ukrainian aircraft, and on their side they have no airplanes, and Russia hasn't provided them. So they fight in almost a early 20th century manner in trenches. The Ukraine army is very poor. You see this even out at the front. They're making they're cooking their own food from crates of potatoes and carrots and canned goods. They're fighting with Kalashnikov rifles with binoculars. Obviously, there's heavy equipment involved as well. But on the front, you see an army of poverty and what looks like maybe a 1960s era technology.
You're working in an area where there are a lot of very savvy players presenting different narratives, and it must be hard to figure things out. I'm wondering if you can talk about how you assess the credibility of information you get, and also, are you ever concerned about being bugged or followed or harmed?
Well, it's obviously a constant struggle to navigate this world of shadows and half-truths that you see in Ukraine, with hackers providing stolen email, stolen information, with activists coming up with evidence of corruption. And at times, when we've reported, I remember one incident in 2017, my colleagues and I spent actually weeks puzzling over one document that came to light before deciding that in fact it was most likely fake. So it can be a real struggle, and you have to triangulate with multiple interviews and be cautious about information that in the war in Ukraine and the broader struggle between Russia and the West is sometimes a weapon.
Well, Andrew Kramer, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Kramer is a reporter for the New York Times based in Moscow. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by country singer John Party. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, developing ways to use the PD-L1 pathway in immunotherapy to treat cancer. Committed to making contributions in cancer treatment for 72 years, DanaFarber.org/everywhere. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Pain and Glory, the new film by Pedro Almodovar, starring Antonio Banderas as a film director, revisiting his past life and his passions, also starring Penelope Cruz, now playing.
This is Fresh Air. Country singer John Pardee says his new collection of songs isn't a throwback, it's just a different era of traditional. Pardee won the Country Music Association's New Artist of the Year Award in 2017. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Pardee's new album called Heartache Medication.
Same old dive, same old end of the work week drink. Bartender knows my name, but I don't mind. She kicks them up strong, serves me up right.
Do I really have to tell you that the magic elixir John Pardee consumes in his song Heartache Medication is the hard stuff? Booze? Hooch? Of course not. Pardee has the kind of singing voice you can easily imagine emanating from the soused depressive down at the end of the bar. He's the sort of barfly who's convinced himself he'd rather be drunk than in love.
She said, I'm tired of those boots being dirty all the time. All your hunting stuff and your three-day scruff, you know I don't lie. And then she started on all my friends and all my drinking. Well, speaking of my friends and speaking of my drinking, I cut her loose and tied one off.
That's Tied One On, which starts off a really nice ballad before shifting rapidly into country rock. When you add it to song titles on this album that include Don't Blame It on the Whiskey, Buy That Man a Beer, Me and Jack, the Jack being Jack Daniels, and the joyously awful title pun of Tequila Little Time, well, you begin to feel grateful that John Pardee worked the recording sessions in around his drinking.
I'm a ghost on the radio. A needle on a vinyl, a country boy survival, the bottom of a bottle, yeah. I'm the fine side of you and me, and my heart's down in Tennessee, and I sing songs about freight trains.
The press release that accompanied this new album quotes the artist as saying, there's a big void to fill in country music, to be more country or traditional. This sounds like a stirring mission statement, but interestingly, John Pardee could not be more wrong, and I suspect he knows it. There's that ominous line in the song I just played, Called Me Country, when he says, I'm a ghost on the radio. I think what he's doing is psyching himself up for an uphill battle with current country radio and fans, who might not be quite as receptive to the excellent honky-tonk music he's making here.
She's got the kind of eyes you want to get lost in. You're gonna look twice when she gets to walk in a honky-tonk with them blue jeans on. She's a cold beer, a whiskey shot, a neon light, a straight song on the jukebox, a dance all night. What a cowboy wants, I never do you wrong. Nobody leaves a girl like that. Nobody walks away and never
last time anyone talked seriously about a traditionalist movement in country music was the 1990s, when Randy Travis brought a baritone whose phrasing echoed George Jones to the top of the charts, and radical throwbacks like Marty Brown and Joy Lynn White were making superb neo-honky-tonk albums that pretty much went nowhere. Ever since then, country's forward momentum has been toward pop. I'm not saying that's bad. I've liked the arena rock and pop kind of country made by Garth Brooks and Taylor Swift, and you can bet Lil Nas X's Old Country Road will be on my year-end top 10 singles list. But all this does leave John Pardee proclaiming a new era for a genre he pretty much embodies all by his lonesome.
These days they call you crazy if you hold the door for a lady. If you don't call her girl, instead of baby, you're out of style, obsolete.
Maybe you've been watching Ken Burns' History of Country Music on PBS, and it's made you want to hear more country that's steeped in the genre's roots. Well, John Pardee's got you covered. His new one is what the old ones used to sound like at their best.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed John Pardee's new album called Heartache Medication.
Pardon me, I don't mean to pry. I saw the tears falling from your eyes and I thought, you're too pretty not to wear a smile. Hope you don't mind if I sit down for a while, 'cause I want to keep a little time with you. A little salt and a lime will do. Hey, barman, will you bring us two? I want to keep a little time with you. Talking it all out.
After we take a short break, Justin Chang will review Martin Scorsese's new film, The Irishman, which stars De Niro, Pacino, and Pesci. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Martin Scorsese's long-awaited new gangster drama, The Irishman, tells the story of the late Frank Sheeran, the union official and mob hitman who claimed responsibility for the 1975 death of Teamster leader Jimmy Hoffa. The movie, which stars Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci, is getting a limited theatrical run before it begins streaming November 27th on Netflix. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Martin Scorsese has made so many terrific crime pictures, you'd be forgiven for doubting if he had another one in him. The great surprise of his haunting and elegiac new movie, The Irishman, is that it doesn't play like a retread so much as a reckoning. It reunites Scorsese with his Goodfellas actors Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci. But while that earlier mob classic had an exhilarating energy, The Irishman is suffused with loss. It feels older, wiser, and infinitely sadder. There are still wisecracks and double crosses and whackings aplenty, but there's no kicky thrill to the violence this time, just a harsh aftertaste of emptiness and futility. Since the movie spans several decades and runs 3.5 hours, That's admittedly a lot of futility. But The Irishman is a richly involving experience. Its measured pace is entirely gripping, and its gorgeous images are well worth seeing in a theater if you live near one of the few venues where it's playing. On a big screen, you might notice some of the minor imperfections of the digital de-aging technology that Scorsese uses to make the actors look younger in different time frames, but you stop noticing them after a few moments as the illusion takes hold. De Niro stars as Frank Sheeran, the Irishman of the title, and the movie is essentially his account of his life and crimes. Shortly before his death from cancer in 2003, Sheeran claimed that he had killed Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa, who had gone mysteriously missing in 1975. One of his former attorneys, Charles Brandt, reported that claim in his biography of Sheeran, I Heard You Paint Houses, which serves as the foundation for Stephen Zalian's screenplay. But Sheeran, narrating his story from a retirement home at the age of 82, has a lot to tell us before he gets to that point. He takes us back to the 1940s, when he was a Pennsylvania truck driver who managed to ingratiate himself with local mafioso Russell Bufalino, wonderfully played by Joe Pesci in a long-overdue return to the screen. Sheeran becomes Bufalino's most reliable hitman. Desensitized to violence by his World War II military service, he kills efficiently and doesn't ask too many questions. He's so good at his job that Bufalino soon introduces him, over the phone, to Hoffa, played by Al Pacino.
Hello? Hi, my friend. How are you? Listen, I got that kid I was talking to you about here. I'm going to put him on the phone and let you talk to him, okay?
Hello?
Is that Frank?
Yes.
Hiya, Frank. This is Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, yeah.
Glad to meet you.
Well, glad to meet you, too.
Even if it's over the phone. I heard you paint houses.
Yes, sir, I do. I do, and I also do my own carpentry.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
I understand you're a brother of mine.
Yes, sir. Local 107 since 1947.
Yeah. You know,
our friend speaks very highly of you.
Well, thank you.
He's not an easy man to please.
Well, I do my best.
Before long, Sheeran is handling Hoffa's dirty work as well. And in their bond, we see the insidious ties between unionized labor and organized crime. The Irishman compresses a lot of tumultuous history into 3.5 hours. There are reenactments of famous mob killings, drive-by references to events such as the Bay of Pigs invasion, and even a brief nod to the conspiracy theory that the mob ordered the assassination of President Kennedy. But for all the movie's historical sweep and its colorful supporting turns by actors like Ray Romano, Bobby Cannavale, and Harvey Keitel, it's the three central personalities that make the movie so engrossing. Scorsese is fascinated by the codes of loyalty that bind Sheeran, Bufalino, and Hoffa, and also by the petty rivalries and power struggles that threaten to destroy them. De Niro, Pesci, and Pacino are at the top of their game, in part because they aren't simply rehashing the iconic gangster types they've played before. Pesci makes Bufalino quiet and calculating, the complete opposite of the short-fused Goodfella that won him an Oscar. Pacino gets to go big and boisterous without tilting into bombast. He pours enormous affection into the role of Hoffa, a man of simple pleasures, he loves ice cream more than anything, and old-school habits, as we see when he unleashes hell on someone who shows up late to a meeting. As for De Niro, he gives a quietly chilling and finally wrenching performance as a man who dutifully aligns himself with evil. The last third of The Irishman slows to a riveting crawl as it reconstructs what may or may not have happened in Hoffa's final hours. Scorsese draws out the tension to an unbearable degree. He wants us to feel in our bones the horror and gravity of what it means to take someone else's life. I haven't yet mentioned Sheeran's wives and children, which is fitting since he mostly treats them as afterthoughts. Scorsese doesn't make the same mistake. It's Sheeran's daughter Peggy, played at different ages by Lucy Gallina and Anna Paquin, who becomes the movie's moral center. Peggy doesn't say much, but her silence cuts right through all the movie's male bluster. With every withering stare, she offers a brutal judgment of her father and the ghastly, corrupt world to which he belongs.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like this week's interviews with Sam Esmail, creator and writer of the TV series Mr. Robot, or with Dan Pipenbring, who edited a new book about Prince and was collaborating with Prince on his memoir before his death, check out our podcast. You'll find lots of Fresh Air interviews. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Neon with Parasite, a dark comedy thriller about two very different families whose fates cross in a tale of class, greed, and deception. Now playing in select cities. Parasite-movie for more theater info. And from The Little Market, offering artisan-made goods and home decor with a commitment to fair trade. A nonprofit founded by women to empower female artisans in marginalized communities around the world. More at thelittlemarket.com.